you. This is Labor Radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7. Thank you.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Hi, this is John Shuck, host of Religion for Life. My guest this week is Nicole Garcia. She is a transgender Latina of faith, the first transgender person of color to seek ordination in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. It is time, beloveds, to make the church queer on Religion for Life. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
Some people look, some people stare, some people turn away, stumbling over words.
The time is 6:30 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Prison Pipeline.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see.
Good evening. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Prison Pipeline, and I'm your host, Emma Lugo. Today, I'm very honored to have a guest with me. His name is Dave Trular, and he is an author. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Emma. It's great to be here.
Prison Pipeline is a show about everything having to do with prisons. It's about prison justice. It's about, for some of us, it's about abolishing the prison industrial complex. It's about educating the general public about all of the issues that have to do with people who are incarcerated. The United States is one of the worst countries in the world for incarcerating its own citizens. And that has created terrible, terrible legacies in this country. And so what we do here at Prison Pipeline is we talk about that. We talk about people's issues. And tonight we're going to be talking one of two-part series about the impact of the war on drugs and the issue of legalization, which has just happened recently. And I'm kind of looking forward to the future. So today we're going to be kind of looking at the past a little bit. We're going to be talking about the war on drugs, what it's done to families, and what the outcome of that is in the prison system. And we're going to talk with somebody who was incarcerated himself and was incarcerated because of a drug crime and is writing a book about it. So welcome, Dave.
Thanks.
So, Dave, first of all, can you tell us just a little bit about yourself right now? For instance, what do you do?
Well, I'm actually just a stay-home dad right now.
Great. Can you tell me a little bit about your kids?
Yeah, I've got three kids, two girls and one boy, and they take up a lot of my time.
Oh, great. And where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Chicago. I moved out here about a year ago.
Oh, great. Well, it must be wonderful having the time to really spend with your daughters. And your son.
Yes, it's a blessing for sure.
And are you married then?
Yes, I'm married. My wife is a public school teacher.
Oh, wonderful. And I see that you're also a writer.
Yeah, I've spent the better part of the last couple years working on this book about mass incarceration in the United States. And it's basically just about my story and the things that I saw and experienced while incarcerated.
Wow. Well, a lot of people were incarcerated starting in the 1970s. The rates of incarceration just went through the roof, and especially during the 1980s when President Reagan and President Bush started the war on drugs, they started incarcerating millions of Americans for nonviolent crimes that mostly had to do with drug possession. Were you one of those people?
Yes, I was.
Well, tell me a little bit about that. What happened?
Well, I was in my house on April 9th, and I looked outside and saw a SWAT team in full body armor holding automatic weapons. descending into my backyard. And they were there because I had a warrant for a possession of marijuana.
So there was a SWAT. That must have been very intimidating to see all of those people like coming to your house to arrest you.
Yeah, it was extremely surreal.
Mm-hmm. Were you expecting something like that? Did you have any idea that might happen to you?
One of my friends had been arrested a few weeks earlier, and I thought that it might happen. I just was kind of choosing to believe it wasn't going to actually happen.
And what did they arrest you for?
Well, my friend was arrested for 2.5 pounds of weed, and then when they arrested me, they charged me with a Class X felony, a Class 1, and a conspiracy charge.
Okay, let's talk about this. Let's talk about the issue of being arrested for, for marijuana. So the whole issue of legalization has just passed recently here in Oregon. And so now a lot of people who might have been arrested last year for possession or for growing now can legally do that. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. I really don't see the point in a drug being illegal when more than half the population doesn't think that it should be.
Is that how you felt back at the time when you were arrested too?
Yes, I did. It was just it was one of those things. I didn't think there was really anything wrong with it. I never really felt like I was a criminal.
But the people who arrested you obviously did think that you were a criminal, so they arrested you. So tell me what happened then.
Well, I had a warrant issued to me from McLean County, which is downstate from Chicago, where I was currently living. I had actually never even set foot in the county, and yet I was charged with possessing marijuana inside of the county. I went to Cook County Jail for a couple of weeks while I waited for them to pick me up. And that is it's just a huge, huge sprawling facility. It sits on 96 acres of land and houses 9,000 inmates at a time. It's actually the largest single-site jail in the country.
So was this the first time you'd ever been arrested in your life?
It was the first time since I was about 18 when I was arrested for possession of marijuana again.
And a lot of people don't understand the difference between a jail and a prison. Can you explain what going to jail means?
Well, when you go to jail, you're awaiting, basically just waiting to go to court and find out what's going to happen for your case.
And what about going to prison? What does that mean?
Prison is where you go once you've been sentenced, and that's where you go to fulfill your debt to society.
Did you feel like you had a debt to society?
I don't think that I did, no.
Do you think that, did you meet a lot of people, did you meet many people who were arrested for drug crimes while you were incarcerated?
Yes, I would say it was more than half.
Do you think that most of the people that you met who were arrested for drug crimes should have been in prison?
Well, there's varying degrees. I don't feel that all drugs are the same. Marijuana, I don't believe that marijuana, people who are arrested for marijuana deserve to go to prison, no.
So looking back, because now hopefully we're going to start looking forward, but looking back, why do you think that our society like had so much invested in arresting people like you and taking away your liberties for marijuana?
Well, a lot of what goes on in this country right now is based on fear-mongering politics. And we live in a society where not only the politicians who make the laws are elected, but also the district attorneys who prosecute you and the judges themselves. So what we end up is with a whole bunch of people who have a vested interest in inflicting maximum pain and suffering upon those who break the law.
So how did it affect your how did it affect your life to be arrested? What happened to you?
Well, when you get arrested, it's basically like your entire life stops. Your bills stop getting paid. It's just everything goes into a limbo state. I wasn't sure if my wife and kids were going to be there when I got out.
So you were married at the time you were arrested?
Yes, I was.
And you had a child?
Yes. Yeah, so, and just sitting in a jail and not knowing what's going to happen in the future is very difficult to do.
What about the day-to-day experience of being in jail? What is that like?
Jail is a lot different from prison in that aspect, because you're basically just waiting to go to trial, and your days are just kind of filled with nothing, really. You watch TV and you try to pass the time, but in the back of your mind is always just the question of what's going to happen to me.
Mm-hmm. And it must be especially like traumatizing and stressful if you have a family. You said that when you're arrested, your bills stop being paid. How did your being arrested affect your family?
It was very, very hard on my wife. She was forced to become a single parent, and she had to work and take care of the kids by herself.
Mm-hmm. And then were there expenses associated with your arrest too?
Yes, there were. My wife had to move out of our house into a much, much tinier house. And she actually had to quit her job and get a new one.
Mm-hmm. But she stuck with you. It sounds like that was one of your fears too, that you might lose your wife or lose your family.
Yeah, I honestly don't know if I could have made it through this whole ordeal without her.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's fair to put people through that for possession of marijuana?
I do not know.
Mm-hmm. So what about people who are in jail right now who are arrested for possession before these laws came into effect? What do you think that we should do about them?
My understanding is that the state was going to drop all low-level marijuana offenses.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean that people who are incarcerated right now in state prisons would be released?
It's one thing that President Obama has promised is to take a retroactive look at everyone who's sitting in prison on marijuana charges, mm-hmm. or just low-level drug offenses in general.
Mm-hmm.
And to this date, I believe he's only commuted just a couple of sentences, mm-hmm. out of over 100,000 requests.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's something that maybe towards the end of his presidency, we're going to see some real action and results.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are any conflicts between the law that was passed in Oregon that just went into effect July 1st and federal law are in conflict? Do you think that at any point, say for instance, if a Republican president were elected, that they might crack down on the states that are in conflict with federal law?
They could. They very well could.
And if they did, what would happen to all of those people who are purchasing marijuana, who are selling, who are using in states like Washington, Oregon, I think the District of Columbia, and one other state?
Well, they would be considered criminals in the eyes of the federal government.
Mm-hmm. And then they could face the same thing that happened to you.
Exactly.
Well, Dave, I know you're an author, and I promised we really need to spend some time talking about your book. And, kind of talking about your experience. So why don't you tell us, something about your book and about your experience?
Okay. After my arrest, I spent a couple of weeks in Cook County Jail. Then I was picked up by McLean County and taken downstate, where I went in front of a judge and a district attorney who proceeded to make me out to be the Pablo Escobar of weed.
Mm-hmm.
I was given a $500,000 bond, which was the highest bond in the entire pod I was in. And my pod included two people charged with attempted murder and six pedophiles.
Mm-hmm. So you were equated with people who attempted murder and pedophiles?
In the eyes of the county, I was worse.
You were worse than that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So after a time there and, they really had barely any evidence against me whatsoever. But due to my high bond, I couldn't bond out to fight the case and prove innocence or anything. So I took a plea deal and I got sentenced to boot camp, mm-hmm. which is a 120-day program.
Mm-hmm.
But
tell me, I think when we were talking earlier, I think you mentioned that originally they were threatening you with 47 years. Was that correct?
Yeah.
Did I hear that right?
Yes, I was facing a total of 47 years in prison. Uh-huh.
Can you explain? Sometimes I don't know if people understand, especially people who haven't been incarcerated, understand how the system works. So when they tell you you're facing 47 years, How do they do that? I mean, is that just some number they make up in their heads? How does it work?
Well, I was charged with three separate felonies, and one of them carried a maximum sentence of 30 years in prison. Mm-hmm. Another one carried a maximum sentence of 15, and another one carried a maximum sentence of 2.
Mm-hmm.
And so I pled guilty to the second charge, which was a possession of more than 2,000 grams of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And so for that, I was sentenced to boot camp with a 7-year sentence hanging behind it.
So what does that mean if there's a 7-year sentence hanging behind your sentence?
That means if I was unable to complete boot camp or quit or was kicked out of the program, I would go to prison for 7 years.
Mm-hmm. So that takes care of the 47 years, but you still have 7 years hanging over your head.
Yeah, well, the worst charge and the third charge were dropped against me as part of the plea deal.
Uh-huh. So is this part of the strategy that, you know, district attorneys use, is to introduce multiple charges in order to coerce, you know, people who have been charged into pleading out? Is that pretty common?
Yes, that's pretty much standard these days. Mm-hmm. They'll charge you with a whole bunch of crimes that there could be little to no evidence of,
mm-hmm.
but they will charge you with it in order to inflate the bond,
mm-hmm.
and keep you in prison so that you're more likely to accept a plea deal.
Mm-hmm. Is that part of how so many people are charged with drug crimes?
Yes, that's
because that's the majority of people incarcerated right now.
Yep. Yeah. From my experiences, that seems to be their general tactic these days, mm-hmm. and it's also how we're seeing a lot of counties and places that have 99% conviction rates, because the deal is if you take something to trial and lose, they hit you with a much more severe penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And my lawyer informed me that if we did take my case to trial and I lost, I would have been sentenced to at least 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So even if you're innocent, because you know, some people are innocent, it sounds like they might still end up in prison anyways, just because they feel like it's better to go to jail if they're innocent than end up in jail for 15 years and then try to fight it after they've been sentenced to 15 years in jail on appeal.
Yes, if you take it to trial, you're definitely rolling the dice with your future.
Mm-hmm.
And you really just don't know which way it could possibly go.
Right. Well, I'm sorry, I keep on distracting us from talking about your book. Let's talk about your book some more.
Okay. Well, like I said, I was sentenced to boot camp, and the only problem with that was due to overcrowding, there was a huge line to get into boot camp. So my next stop was Stateville Penitentiary, which is a huge facility. It's half the size of the Mall of America, and it processes 6,000 to 7,000 inmates per month into the penal system.
Mm-hmm. So just to sidetrack for a second again, so it's a processing facility. Maybe people don't understand exactly how it works. And was this state prison or federal?
It was a state prison.
So yeah, with state prison. When you say it's a processing center, maybe people don't understand what happens once you've been sentenced. What is a processing center?
It's where all of the inmates will go to a processing center first, and they sit in limbo until a bed opens up in a different facility. And mm-hmm. then they will end up at that facility to complete the remainder of their sentence.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like where you check into the whole prison system, basically.
Exactly. You're processed in.
And do they do like psychological tests on you, physical? Do they, you know, kind of do any kind of mental health evaluations or check about your diet and try to find, you know, a good match for you, that sort of thing?
What I saw was just they process you in, but you know, you're in front of a dentist for about 10 seconds, mm-hmm. and a counselor for about like 20 or 30 seconds. So mm-hmm. there's really you know, there's nothing in depth going on there.
So it's just like a warehouse, basically. It's just a place to warehouse you until they figure out where else to warehouse you.
Exactly. You definitely feel like you're cattle getting right. prodded along.
Right. Well, I know that you brought along a couple of excerpts from your book. I would really like it if you could, you know, share one of those.
Okay. Well, like I said, Stateville is a transitional facility, and with there being a 5-month wait for me to go to boot camp, I was held there for 86 straight days. The cells are 6 foot by 9 foot, and I was only allowed out of my cell once a week to take a 2-minute shower and go outside for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much standard standard processing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'd like to read an excerpt from my time in Stateville. I'm not exactly sure how long I've been locked in this tiny room. There are no windows and no sunlight touches the filthy gray wall across from my cell. Food trays are repeatedly shoved through the chuck hole, but I've lost the ability to care which particular meal it is. Breakfast comes at 2 a.m., lunch at 10 a.m., and dinner around 5 p.m. It's ridiculous to keep a real sleep pattern like that, so I eat, sleep, and stare at the wall 3 times a day. Then I do it all over again tomorrow, the day after, and all the days following until the days become weeks and the weeks stretch out into months. I try not to allow my thoughts to wander too far ahead, but staring at the wall is just not as fun as it used to be. Nicknamed Hotel Hell by the first groups of inmates to pass through its doors a few years ago, Stateville Correctional Center is so large, transportation vehicles are used to go from one wing to the other, inside of the actual building. It was hailed as a modern wonder, a glimpse into the future of what mass incarceration in America could be. Prison officials everywhere marveled at its ability to make do with only a couple hundred guards at a time, while processing thousands of inmates through its doors each month. The state classifies Stateville as a transitional holding facility. At its inception, a stay of only a week or two was intended before an inmate was shipped to his respective prison, his final resting place to serve out his debt to society. Now many inmates sit here for several months due to overcrowding, and you can now be legally held here indefinitely. None are given the federally mandated 1 hour out of the cell per day that even the worst serial murders in America get. Make no doubt about it, we are being processed like cattle.
Wow. So one of the issues that you had to deal with at Stateville was that you didn't get let out of your cell. And you said it was a 6x9 cell?
Yes, that you share with one other inmate.
And you shared it with one other person. Did you have any, like, did you have any fresh air in the cell? Did you have any sunshine?
No, there's no sunshine. You can't see outside.
You can't see outside?
Nope. The only thing, there's one window, and when you look out, all you see is a gray wall.
And all you saw was a gray wall.
Yes.
Did you have anything to read? Could you?
No TV, and my wife had tried to send me books a couple times, but they never got there.
Uh-huh. Did you get along with your cell? With your cellie?
You kind of have to.
Wow, that sounds awful.
Yeah, so we sat
why
there.
Why don't they let you, why wouldn't they let you out of your cell?
They don't have the faculty to do it.
They don't have enough guards?
Exactly.
Oh my goodness, isn't that a violation of your rights?
I definitely thought it was.
Uh-huh.
There was a class action lawsuit that was about to be filed against the state on behalf of us boot camp inmates. And as a result, after 86 days of that,
uh-huh.
They shipped us to a medium security facility
uh-huh.
to finish out our wait.
Do you think that your story is, do you think that stories like this still happen to people who are incarcerated around the country?
Yes, for sure.
Wow. Because I think a lot of people think that when you go to jail, you know, you're still treated with some respect and dignity in jail. Like, you know, you're fed and you get to go out and walk around the yard. And, you know, people see shows on television and they think that, you know, well, people have all kinds of ideas about jail and prison.
Yeah, for the first 3 weeks I was in Stateville, I did not have a spoon to eat with
mm-hmm.
or a toothbrush.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And asking a guard for one was not working.
Did you have a chance to see your wife or your child while you were imprisoned?
I did. When I got to the medium security prison, she did come and visit me right before I went to boot camp.
Uh-huh. How long could you see your wife, like, every week?
Well, since I was so far downstate,
uh-huh.
I only saw her once.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And this is someone you really love.
Exactly.
And you only saw her once.
Yes. And our visit was cut short by half also.
It was cut in half?
Yep.
Did they give any reason for that?
Nope.
They just did that to you?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, that just sounds horrible.
Yeah, and receiving a visit in prison is not... It's nice, but it's not... you know, it's like there's someone watching you. If I want to hold my child, there's someone staring at me.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely no real connection.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. I can't believe this, but I mean, you're right. We could have talked about this for hours. We haven't even gotten to like half of the stuff I wanted to get to. I'm not sure if we'll have a chance to read another excerpt or not, but let's talk about, you know, kind of the happy ending of the story. So you went through boot camp and then what happened?
Yeah. Boot camp was difficult. Uh-huh. It was, it's definitely set up like a military style boot camp. Uh-huh. So, you know, your head is shaved as soon as you get there. Uh-huh. They kind of strip everything away from you, including your name. For the entire 120 days, you're known as inmate.
Uh-huh.
And that was a difficult program to go through.
Mm-hmm.
Involved you wake up at 4 a.m. and you do run 6 miles, mm-hmm. do hundreds of push-ups, sit-ups. Mm-hmm.
So it's like being in the military.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. And the idea is to make you into a man or something.
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh. It's so, just, yeah.
But yeah, the program is meant to instill discipline.
Uh-huh. Do you think you had discipline? I mean, it sounds like you were a business person and you were married and you had a house and a family. So it sounds like you already had a lot of discipline.
Yes, I was definitely slightly out of place there. I'd say 90% of the boot camp was just kids, teenagers, yeah, from the projects of Chicago.
Wow. Well, now you're back. And are you happy to be out of prison?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm definitely glad to be out here in Oregon, where I think everything's a little bit more open-minded.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really hoping that the state gets the legalization process correct.
Uh-huh. Great. So, you know, we do have maybe 3 or 4 minutes left, but I want to make sure that before we get to the last minute or two, that we have a chance to plug your book and tell people where they can learn more about you. I don't know if you have any, like, anything in social media or anything that you want people to know about you, but if you do, now's the time to share it.
Yeah, I currently do not have a website or anything up and running.
Okay.
My book is called The Mass Incarceration of Me. And hopefully it will be out soon.
Uh-huh. Great. How long have you been writing?
This book for about 2 years now. Yeah.
I know you're a pretty involved writer because I learned about you through the writers groups.
Yes.
So, yeah, that must take a lot of discipline to talk about your story. Then you have to, like, rethink it. You have to sort of re-experience it. And, you know, that must be a difficult too, just remembering things like that.
Yes, it's not an easy process.
Does it feel good though to, like, is there something cathartic about writing about this injustice that happened to you? I mean,
yes. Originally when I first started writing this book, it was really just all about me. And mm-hmm. this is when I was about halfway through my incarceration. And then I really came to the realization that these people from the low income areas, their lives have been just devastated by the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the real victims, not
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm. So you met a lot of people whose lives had been devastated by the war on drugs.
Yes, many, many people, and I remain very good friends with them all to this day.
Oh, that's great. Well, do you think that what's happening in Oregon is kind of a sign of things changing, of better things to come?
Yes, I think the country as a whole is ready for change.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Because I know that we still have a lot of states where, like, for instance, Idaho, I heard that in Idaho, drug arrests are up fivefold because, you know, there's so much traffic going through Idaho from Washington and Oregon where it's legal.
Yes.
So it sounds like people are still being victimized by the war on drugs.
Yes, I definitely believe so.
But maybe things are changing.
Yeah, well, hopefully we'll see as more states start to bring legalization to the front. I think we're really going to see some change nationwide.
Mm-hmm. And what about in the next year or two? What are you seeing as positive developments here in Oregon? Do you think that I know that they've moved ahead the law for allowing people to sell the dispensaries to like October 1st of this year? That was a bump ahead of almost a year that the state legislature did. That must be a positive development because my understanding is right now you can't actually buy marijuana in Oregon, but it's legal to smoke it. So
yes,
I'm not sure how you would get it.
And I definitely believe that allowing the dispensaries to be the ones who are also going to sell the drug recreationally is a really smart plan.
Yeah.
Because I know they were talking about having separate facilities for that.
Yeah. Well, I know that we're going to get into a lot of that next week, on next week's show for Prison Pipeline. And I see that we just have about a minute left, so we're going to start to wrap it up here. We've been talking today with Dave Trular. Dave, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Well, thanks for having me.
My name is Emma Lugo, and you're listening to Prison Pipeline. We are a weekly show. You can hear us every Monday at 6:30 here on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM. Thank you so much for being with us tonight, and have a good evening.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Attention, KBOO members. You are invited to give your feedback on KBOO's draft mission and vision statements. Based on member feedback from the recent survey and member retreat, KBOO board and staff members created draft mission and vision statements. Now we want to know what you think. This is your chance to help define KBOO's guiding principles and priorities. Visit KBOO.fm to review the draft mission and vision statements and submit your comments. Paper copies of the draft statements are also available at the station. Comments are due July 17th. If you have questions, please contact Monica Beamer at monica@kboo.org. Thank you for contributing to the development of KBOO's mission and vision statements and for your support of Community Radio.